most Democratic representatives in Congress are likely to find those cuts unpalatable, just as many Republicans would.
Debating revenue projections and budget cuts in the Republican tax overhaul. From Alaska Public Media, this is Statewide News on Alaska News Nightly for Monday, December 11th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, a Canadian mine permit can move forward despite objections from Alaskans.
They did not consider at all whether that communication between Seabridge Gold and SEAC was adversarial at all.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Opioids are common prescription pain relievers and must be used properly to avoid danger. Common opioids include hydrocodone, oxycodone, morphine, fentanyl, and codeine. Safely getting rid of unused opioid medication prevents children and pets from accidental poisoning and protects the environment. Information about safe opioid storage and proper disposal is at opioids.alaska.gov. This message is sponsored by the State of Alaska Department of Health and Social Services.
The number of homicides in Alaska's largest city has again hit an all-time high. Anchorage police have investigated 34 killings in the city so far this year, including a fatal shooting near downtown on Sunday that led to a standoff and ultimately the suspect's arrest on murder charges. The shooting would have matched last year's homicide tally, which was the most ever in the city. But Alaska State Troopers now say a man found dead earlier this month in the Jim Creek area east of Palmer is the victim of a homicide that also occurred in Anchorage. That brings the total number of homicides in Anchorage to 35, the most ever in the city, with nearly 3 weeks remaining in 2017. The U.S. Senate tax bill would open the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge to oil lease sales and split revenues with the state 50-50. Some Alaskans insist the state should get 90% as promised in the Statehood Act. But if the tax bill passes, some opponents warn the state's actual revenues from ANWR, no matter how much oil companies bid, could be zero. Alaska Public Media Washington correspondent Liz Ruskin explains.
Matt Lee Ashley sees lots of reasons not to pass the tax bill. He works for the Center for American Progress, a liberal think tank. But he wants Alaskans to know the $1 billion the Congressional Budget Office projects the state would get from the first decade of lease sales in the refuge may never materialize.
For the next 10 years, if the tax bill passes, there would be no money going back to the state of Alaska from mineral leasing in the state on federal lands.
So, he says, no money to the state from oil leases in ANWR due to a budget control law known as PAYGO. Lee Ashley was an Interior Department official during the Obama administration. He acknowledges this zero-day scenario is not certain. But legally, if Congress passes the tax bill and takes no further action, that could trigger automatic spending cuts under PAYGO. And far more than ANWR revenues are at stake. Congress passed PAYGO, or the Statutory Pay-as-You-Go Act, years ago to try to stop itself from adding to the deficit. If Congress spends more than it brings in, PAYGO imposes immediate budget cuts. And Lee Ashley says that's where Congress is heading.
The tax bill obviously would result in a massive increase to the budget deficit and therefore trigger cuts to other federal programs.
Some programs are protected. PAYGO can't touch Social Security payments, for instance, or veterans benefits. Medicare, the insurance program for older people, is partially protected but could lose $25 billion a year. Lee Ashley points to a report from the Congressional Budget Office that says the remaining unprotected programs don't add up to nearly as much as the Republican tax bill is projected to cost.
And therefore, those programs would be entirely eliminated.
Among the 200-plus programs that would be subject to the automatic acts are social service block grants, certain highway and airport funds, student loans, money for crime victims, and the payments to Western states for oil drilling on federal lands. That's the category that would include ANWR revenues. Unless otherwise protected, in the event of a big deficit, these programs could be reduced to zero. How likely do you think that scenario is?
Not very likely.
Jim Capretta worked for the White House Office of Management and Budget under George W. Bush. He's now at the American Enterprise Institute, a conservative think tank. He says it's possible a lot of programs could be zeroed out, but it's not probable for political reasons.
Most Democratic representatives in Congress are likely to find those cuts unpalatable, just as many Republicans would, including a very large cut in Medicare. And so I think there will end up being bipartisan support to waive the cuts.
Congress can pass another bill saying the PAYGO Act doesn't apply or doesn't apply to certain programs. Republican leaders have already pledged to stop a PAYGO cut to Medicare. A PAYGO waiver would have to be separate from the tax legislation, and it would likely take 60 votes to get it passed. But Capretta says that shouldn't be a problem, because these cuts would be so unpopular, Congress would feel compelled to block PAYGO from going into effect.
It's just the amounts that are required now under the tax bill would be so large that I think they would almost surely have to be undone.
For Alaska's congressional delegation and others in favor of oil development in the Arctic Refuge, the benefits go beyond the revenue the state is supposed to get from the first lease sales. To them, ANWR means jobs, a boost to the economy, and, if all goes well, more oil for the Trans-Alaska Pipeline. Reporting from Washington, I'm Liz Ruskin.
An Alaska environmental group has lost its appeal of a large Canadian mine planned for just across the border. The developer says the decision shows it's behaving responsibly, but the conservation group says project owners and Canada's government didn't follow their own rules. Coast Alaska's Ed Schoenfeld has details.
About a year ago, the Southeast Alaska Conservation Council tried a new tool to protest plans for the Kerr-Sulphuritz-Mitchell transboundary mine project. It appealed to a Canadian agency called the National Contact Point. CX Guy Archibald says it's supposed to address international business disputes.
We're exploring every venue we can to try to protect the transboundary rivers and the communities and fisheries they support from the large-scale development of Canadian mines across the border.
It tried to convince Canadian authorities that project owners didn't follow guidelines requiring stakeholder engagement and environmental protections. But last month, the agency rejected that appeal.
There is no formal requirement for us to engage in Alaska.
Rudy Franck is chairman and CEO of Seabridge Gold. The Toronto-headquartered corporation owns the KSM and another British Columbia mine exploration project.
The confirmation from the National Contact Point in Canada just clearly reinforces the process we went through during the environmental assessment process, that the engagement we had not only with the Canadian authorities, but also with the Alaskan authorities was appropriate and bountiful.
SEAC acknowledges meetings took place involving conservation, tribal, fisheries, and other Southeast Alaska groups. But Archibald says the Canadian government failed to look into what happened at those meetings.
They did not consider at all whether that communication between Seabridge Gold and SEAC was adversarial at all or particularly informative at all. Just that Seabridge had attended some meetings, presented their PowerPoint, and that was adequate.
Seabridge Gold says it's listened to concerns and made changes in its plans. For example, it moved its tailings storage site at the request of British Columbia tribal leaders, and Franck says it added protections to its design for that site, where waste rock is kept after being processed.
There is no requirement, or there was no requirement in British Columbia to actually line the tailings facility, but we agreed that we would line a portion of the tailings facility to deal with material that went through the mill that would actually touch cyanide.
The company continues drilling at its KSM site to locate more valuable concentrations of gold, copper, and other metals, but its biggest challenge is to find investors or partners to turn the exploration project into a mine. Franck says the corporation has turned down several offers because they were not the right match. He says non-disclosure agreements prevent him from identifying those companies. SEAC, meanwhile, continues to push for high-level talks between U.S. and Canada's federal governments. It, other organizations, the Walker-Mulott administration, and Alaska's congressional delegation want stronger protections for Alaska fisheries. I'm Ed Schoenfeld, reporting in Juneau.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, a controversial statue in Sitka has residents taking sides.
And I think that's the power of the narrative and who gets to create the meaning. Sure, you can stay there if we tell the whole story.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
The University of Alaska's founders knew that to build a great state, we would need a great university. Today, UA offers more than 400 degrees and certificates with campuses from Kotzebue to Ketchikan. They are leaders in Arctic and Alaska research and dedicated to direct hands-on teaching, whether online, in the classroom, or in the field. Greatness awaits you. See how the University of Alaska can help you achieve at alaska.edu/start here. This message sponsored by the University of Alaska.
The Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority's Board of Directors last week approved selling Pentex Alaska Natural Gas Company and its assets, including Fairbanks Natural Gas, to the Interior Gas Utility. KUAC's Tim Ellis reports.
ADA's 7-member board made its sale of Pentex to the IGU official Thursday with unanimous votes on 4 resolutions that each addressed different aspects of the sale. Before the first vote, board member Gary Wilkin of Fairbanks likened ADA and IGU to 2 members of a football team that was finally ready to score after nearly a year of due diligence and negotiations over the deal.
Today, I hope we're going to take that ball and pass it to IGU, and they're going to score a touchdown and make this an investment-grade utility that benefits Interior Alaska.
Bernie Carl is another Fairbanksan who serves on the board. He said he would have preferred a better deal, but he urged his fellow board members to approve the one before them.
I'm telling you, this is the best deal we have going. So we have to go for it.
In his comments, Board Chairman Dana Prues pointed out 2 advantages to the 3-year gas supply contract that comes as part of the deal. He says it freezes the gas price at the present level, which should protect IGU ratepayers from price hikes, and it allows an increase in volume without any price penalty. Prues says that should help the IGU as it brings on additional customers by convincing them to convert from fuel oil or firewood or other heating sources.
The hurdle I see is the focus on conversions, and that's critical.
The deal approved Thursday calls for IGU to buy Pentex for $54 million, the amount ADA paid for the company in 2015. Pentex's assets include Fairbanks Natural Gas, the Titan Alaska LNG production facility in Point McKenzie down in South Central, and other subsidiaries that manage LNG storage and transport for Pentex. When it came his turn to vote, Carl made his support trebly clear.
Mr. Carl.
Yes, yes, yes.
The 4th and final vote on the deal called for construction of an additional LNG storage tank and processing facilities in Fairbanks. The complex, including the 5.25 million gallon tank, would cost $45.5 million to build and would be paid for through a loan that ADA has offered as part of the whole Pentex sale package. Dan Britton, president of both Pentex and Fairbanks Natural Gas, says the tank would provide capacity for additional customers who convert to natural gas, and he says it would boost the city's existing gas storage capacity from 5 days' supply up to 40 days' supply. Britton says site work on the project will begin almost immediately. In Fairbanks, I'm Tim Ellis.
A dramatic decline in Gulf of Alaska Pacific cod stocks forced regulators to slash the fishery's total catch by about 80% on Saturday. The council set the allowable catch for cod in the Gulf at about 13,000 metric tons, down from about 64 metric tons in 2017. The North Pacific Fishery Management Council, which regulates groundfish in the Gulf and Bering Sea, made the move due to a roughly 70% decline in Pacific cod. Cod is Alaska's second largest commercial fishery by volume. It brought in $168 million in 2015. Dr. Stephen Barbeau works with the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration's Fisheries Division. Barbeau says the decline is likely due to a body of warm water that moved into the Gulf 3 years ago, referred to as the blob.
That warm anomaly, went all the way down to 300 meters. So there's no place these cod really could go.
that they weren't encountering these warmer temperatures.
Warm water boosts the metabolism of cod and other marine life, causing them to eat more. Increased demand on the food supply led to smaller fish, making cod more susceptible to predation and environmental factors. Warm temperatures were also tough on juvenile cod, and stocks are expected to continue declining.
Projected to reach an all-time low in 2020, so we're not at the bottom of the barrel yet. We're still going down. Due to high mortality of the 2011-2012 age classes and expected poor recruitment in 2013-2016, we still expect this stock to continue downward.
But it wasn't all bad news. Barbeau told the council cooler waters are likely to move into the Gulf this winter, which should boost cod stocks if the pattern holds. Pacific cod stocks in the Bering Sea and along the Aleutian Islands saw a drop of about 40%. The council reduced the allowable catch for 2018 by about 14% in those areas. The Alaska Department of Fish and Game expects considerably lower numbers of Chinook salmon for the Stikine and Taku Rivers. KSTK's June Leffler has more.
The department forecasts there will be less than 7,000 Chinook salmon making it back to spawn in the Stikine River near Wrangell next year, and just 5,000 in the Taku River near Juneau. Neither preseason terminal run number provides an allowable catch for U.S. and or Canadian fisheries. For the Taku, the amount is 4 times less than the department's minimum goal range for kings returning to river. Dave Harris is the Juneau area manager for Fish and Game.
I believe they are the poorest forecast we've ever come up with for these rivers.
These numbers are 60% lower than last year's forecasts, which still weren't that high. The forecasts mean very little chance of early season commercial gill netting or trawling to target those king salmon. Those fisheries, when they're open, are typically in May. But low numbers could have broader impact on both sport and commercial fishing.
Well, there's going to be some quite draconian restrictions, in at least the gill netters, and I believe the recreational fisheries, the troll fisheries, the seine fisheries, basically all the fisheries that target salmon will have some form of restriction or another designed to minimize their impacts on these species.
Historically low returns of kings to rivers in southeast Alaska last year prompted an unprecedented region-wide Chinook closure for both commercial and sport fisheries. The state's Board of Fish will be addressing management of southeast king salmon at a meeting in January in Sitka. In Wrangell, I'm June Leffler.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Do you need health insurance for next year? Did you know Alaska's individual market health insurance rates have dropped by more than 20% for 2018? More than 90% of Alaskans who sign up at healthcare.gov are eligible for tax credits to help pay the cost. Open enrollment is November 1st through December 15th of this year. Check out healthcare.gov to find out what your insurance options are for 2018. This message sponsored by the Alaska Division of Insurance.
Planning today for a gift down the road builds a legacy of support for the media you treasure. Thank you for considering this public radio station in your estate planning. You can talk to your financial advisor or contact your public radio station to learn more. Thank you.
Sometimes when young people are in rough situations, they don't want to ask for help, especially not from adults. That's where peer outreach workers step in. Alaska youth advocates have been connecting with youth on the streets of Anchorage and helping them find resources for 25 years. Alaska Public Media's Solutions Desk reporter Ann Hillman has more.
20-year-old Nichelle used to hang out at the Alaska Youth Advocates Drop-In Center over a year ago, but she says she was different then. She was using drugs.
When I was using, it was like I wasn't thinking about how I was treating other people. I wasn't, you know, I didn't take other people's into consideration.
Since then, she's sobered up a couple of times, moved around a bit. Over the summer, she was homeless and camping in the woods. One day, two peer outreach workers saw her hanging out in a park and let her know she was still welcome at AYA's drop-in center whenever she was ready. Nichelle says, at first, she was too embarrassed to go back to AYA. People at the center had seen her at her worst.
It was a nerve-wracking experience at first, but then when I came in here, I saw that they were here to support me and not judge me.
That's one of the key ideas behind the center, accepting young people as they are. It's part of a strategy used around the world that focuses on leveraging young people's strengths as a way to help them learn how to be healthy adults. In order for it to work, youth have to feel safe, supported, and accepted. Serena Nestaby, the adult who coordinates the program, says sometimes it's easier for that to happen when young people are leading the effort.
You know, it's easier for youth to talk to other youth. It's easier for them to connect with someone who's their same age, who maybe went through the same or similar experiences as them.
And it's not as if the workers are sent out unprepared. They each have to go through 3 months of intensive training on everything from addiction to housing to balancing school and work. They're bringing up those skills in casual conversations and when teaching formal presentations. Ivory, a peer outreach worker, even demonstrates her favorite coping skill on a regular basis in the drop-in center kitchen. Baking. She finishes beating a bowl of cake batter.
Yeah, it just gives me something to do, and, like, it's good for me.
18-year-old Ivory is balancing motherhood with work and will soon start college, too. When she dropped out of high school because of bullying and got pregnant at 15, she says she didn't have a support network.
No, my family wasn't supportive of me. They actually told me that I wasn't going to succeed and that I was just going to sit at home and not do anything with my life.
She didn't know about AYA or other resources, but now, as an outreach worker, she can fill the knowledge gap for other young parents. She lets them know that
they're, like, not the only people out there. Like, they're important, too, and they can still finish high school, and they can still have a job, they can still do everything that everybody else does when they're older with children.
But here's the catch. Ivory says having a person like that in her life when she was pregnant, or even having a safe place to go, like the drop-in center, would not have helped her. She says she needed to struggle to prove to herself and her family that she could do it. AYA would not have been a good solution for her. But she says she sees how it does help others, like Nichelle. After Nichelle finally came back to the youth center, she eventually developed enough courage to apply for a job to be a peer outreach worker. Now she's in training and says learning everything is hard.
There's a lot of it. It makes me nervous because there's a lot of information you have to remember.
She says working at the youth center forces her to be more outgoing and to face some of her past experiences. More than once, she's come into work and burst into tears. She says she used to apologize for her weaknesses, but not anymore.
Youth here, they see that I can be vulnerable and it's okay for me to cry. Like, it can send a message to them that it's okay for them to cry in here, and it makes it more of a safe place.
The peer outreach workers interacted with 300 different young people last year. More than half were homeless. Some just received hygiene products, snacks, and information. Others came to the center to cook a pot of spaghetti or get help finding housing. The outreach workers met them where they were at, literally. From the Solutions Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
Earlier this fall, a group of Sitkins renewed a conversation about a piece of bronze art in the heart of downtown. Alexander Baranov was the first general manager of the Russian-American company, but for many, Baranov and the Russian-American company are synonymous with colonization and the systematic oppression of Alaska Natives. KCAW's Catherine Rose met with people on both sides of the issue.
There's a bronze statue in front of Harrigan Centennial Hall. It's nearly to scale, a man sitting hunched over beneath flags flapping in the wind, looking pensively in the distance. The man is Alexander Baranov, manager of the Russian-American company in the early 1800s. On the plaque beneath him is a quote, "That we may dwell in amity and peace forever in this region." But for Louise Brady, the statue doesn't bring her peace.
You know, it is really a symbol of, to me, now that I know, of epidemics, of assimilation, of bad policy, and destruction of a way of life.
Last summer, as momentum grew in the South to tear down Confederate monuments, some Sitkins started to wonder about their own legacies to the past. Larry Edwards wrote a letter to the editor of the Sitka Sentinel calling for the removal of the Baranov statue. Martina Kurzer, his wife, signed it.
This thing about this Baranov statue didn't bother me at all in the beginning until I learned the finer fabric of Sitka. And I started to understand how simply the statue, having the statue there, rubs in again and again and again the fact that the people who have been here on this land for 10,000, 14,000 years, they are not, you know, in charge of this land anymore.
Brady says there's a reason some don't understand her discomfort with the statue.
I think it ties into privilege. I think it ties into, you know, being able to say, I love living here. This is a beautiful place. And, you know, I can just be here without understanding that there's people who have been here for 10,000 years who were just granted citizenship less than 100 years ago.
The controversy swirling around the Baranoff statue isn't anything new. A gift to the city from Lloyd and Barbara Hames in 1989, the statue caused tension from the get-go. The night before the statue was dedicated, someone cut off its nose. That was after discovering that the head would be too hard to remove. The artist was able to repair it with putty for the ceremony the next day. It was defaced again in 2013 with cuts to its nose and forehead. For Hal Spackman of the Sitka Historical Society, the statue tells the story of the Russian settlement. He says it was built to honor Sitka's merchant past. While that doesn't reflect the feelings of all Sitkins on their history, he says the fact that it happened means it's worth remembering.
We need to value all perspectives. And it doesn't mean that we devalue any perspectives. And that I hope that we all can use those conversations to not just celebrate history, but to discuss history in ways that are productive and help us move forward as a society.
But Brady thinks the perspective the statue represents is one that's told too often.
And I think that's the power of the narrative and who gets to create the meaning. Sure, you can stay there if we tell the whole story.
For now, the bronze Baranoff still sits downtown. Tourists take pictures of this relatively small monument, most unaware of the large conversation that surrounds him. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Catherine Rose.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at alaskapublic.org. We had reports tonight from Casey Grove and Ann Hillman in Anchorage, Liz Ruskin in Washington, D.C., Ed Schoenfeld in Juneau, Aaron Bolton in Homer, Tim Ellis in Fairbanks, June Leffler in Wrangell, and Catherine Rose in Sitka. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron, Wesley Early is our web editor, and I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, sustaining Alaska's pipeline for 40 years and counting.
And by
Wells Fargo, offering financial tools to start, run, and grow a business. Learn more at wellsfargoworks.com.
Older Persons Action Group publishes Senior Voice, Alaska's only statewide publication for seniors, and is an excellent source of information for families and caregivers. SeniorVoiceAlaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG.
The U.S. Bureau of Land Management, the lead federal agency, is hosting a series of public scoping meetings on the proposed Ambler Road. The meetings are now through Tuesday, December 12th, in several communities near the Ambler Mining District. The BLM is developing an environmental impact statement and seeking public input. Learn more at blm.gov/AmblerRoadEIS. This message is sponsored by BLM.
Support for public radio comes from the communities we serve. Whether you give as an individual member or through your business, know that your contribution makes possible programming that informs, inspires, and entertains. We thank you for the role you play in your public radio station. This is Statewide News on Alaska Public Media.